The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, instead of reading from the normal magazine, we're going to have The Week Extra, as I call it, where we're going to look at some of the best articles from some of the sections that we don't normally read, and I think that you will enjoy it. I hope so, anyway. Thanks for joining us today on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Our first article today is entitled, Is Education the Next Bubble? Higher learning is just an overpriced, speculative investment that typically rewards graduates with dismal career prospects, says billionaire Peter Thiel. Billionaire libertarian businessman Peter Thiel, the founder and former CEO of PayPal, is perhaps best known as the venture capitalist who gave Facebook the angel investment it needed to really get started. But increasingly, he's getting attention for his controversial views on higher learning. Last year, he launched the Thiel Fellowship, which gives grants as large as $100,000 to 20 tech entrepreneurs who drop out of college by age 20 to pursue their own ideas. Then, in a National Review interview earlier this week, Thiel said that higher education is a bubble in the classic sense because education is overpriced, something people have an intense belief in and an investment that's unlikely, in the majority of cases, to have a positive return. He made the point again recently at TechCrunch. Given the financial disaster of student loan debt surpassing credit card debt, does Thiel have a point? No, education isn't about returns on an investment. The concept of the education bubble is based on horrifying false logic, says Freddie DeBoer and LeHote. To see an education, college or otherwise, is merely a way to increase the amount of money you make is a terrible corruption and fundamentally unsustainable. Increasing earning potential was never meant to be the sole purpose of education, and if it's reduced to that, we are all in trouble. Well, college is overpriced. College has gotten too expensive, with state governments cutting aid to public universities, says E.D. Kane in Forbes magazine. But let's not abandon institutions of higher learning. If we need it, we should raise taxes to make public investments more affordable. Yes, education costs money, but that money should not fall squarely on the heads of middle-class kids who are forced to take out tens of thousands of dollars in debt just to attend school. And grad school is a particularly poor investment. College is still a good decision for most young Americans, but I can't say the same about grad school, says Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic. Grad school has become a socially acceptable way to drink beer, read, and go into massive debt in your 20s. Upper middle class Americans tend to overvalue the non-financial benefits of grad school. Feels wrong about a lot. But at least he's challenging the cultural assumptions that cause a lot of people to make bad life decisions. And when did America begin its decadent decline? Here are four theories about that question. The Washington Post's E.J. Dion says America has conclusively begun to rot with Wienergate. Others peg earlier events as our point of no return. At what point do we decide that a political system has become decadent? Asked Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion. For Dion, America lost its last shreds of dignity and restraint a la ancient Rome during the recent media circus over Representative Anthony Weiner's sexting scandal. He's the Democrat from New York. Others believe our tipping point came earlier. Here are four alternate events that signaled our point of no return. The first point, the outsourcing spree from the 1990s. Americans' addiction to entertainment, be it sex scandals or reality TV, is our version of the bread and circuses that lulled underworked Romans into decline, says Alice Schroeder at Bloomberg News. And America's debilitating debauchery is directly tied to the draconian outsourcing of manufacturing jobs that surged in the 1990s. We became a nation of servers, not makers. Sure, for a while we can use our dwindling paychecks to buy the cheaper TVs and laptops we import, but soon we'll buy ourselves out of jobs, like the Romans did. Getting sacked by the Visigoths won't be far behind. And now here's the second theory about when America went into a decline. Bush versus Gore, 2000. If America is broken, I heard my first unmistakable crack a bit more than 10 years ago when a colossally corrupt U.S. Supreme Court threw the 2000 election to George W. Bush in an ineffably dim-witted ruling, says P.M. Carpenter at his blog. U.S. elections have been stolen before, but this particular chicanery ushered in 8 years of lawlessness, self-destructive military adventures, torture, horrific and costly financial recklessness, and other awful transgressions. We long ago hit our point of no return, and I'm really supposed to be upset by Anthony Weiner's cyber boners? And the next theory is the last Bush years were the turning point, 2006 to 2008. I can't pin down the exact moment when we became late Imperial Rome, says Andrew Sullivan at the Daily Beast, but to me it came at some point between Congress' assent to torture in 2006, when we abandoned so many of our long-valued principles, and when Sarah Palin was selected as a serious vice presidential nominee in 2008. It's been downhill ever since. And the fourth and final theory here, as written by E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post, the Great Recession of 2008. There are lots of reasons America in 2011 is Rome in 200 A.D. or Britain on the eve of the First World War. In other words, an empire at the zenith of its power, but with cracks beginning to show, says Larry Elliott at The Guardian. Most of them have to do with money or America's advanced state of cultural decadence, or both, as with the main cause of America's slow collapse, the housing boom and the subsequent spectacular bust. As previous empires show, it is hard to stop the rot once it has set in, and China's already gunning to be the next great empire. Now let's turn to some recent articles from the Health and Science section of The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Commuting, the Ultimate Home Wrecker? Should be interesting. Commuting has been blamed for back problems, stress, and obesity, not to mention mindless drive-time radio. Now we can add divorce to that list. A new Swedish study says couples are 40% more likely to split up if one partner has a daily commute of longer than 45 minutes each way. Commuting may seem like a positive thing because it means you don't have to uproot your family when you land a new job, study author Erica Sandow, a social geographer at Umeå University, tells the Swedish Local. But it can also be a strain on your relationship. About one in six Americans has a round-trip daily commute of 90 minutes, and 3.5 million people have to travel that long just one way, twice as many as did 20 years ago. Commuting often results in a higher salary and better job opportunities, but experts say there are many ways that living far from work puts pressure on a marriage. Since long-distance commuters are most often men, for example, their female partners tend to take on a disproportionate share of housekeeping duties, a common source of discord. Our next item from the Health and Science section, acidic oceans deafen the fish. A new British study shows that climate change may be robbing fish of their ability to hear and thus avoid danger, BBCNews.com reports, as oceans absorb increasing amounts of carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels. They become more acidic, and that process could lead to populations of very lost fish, University of Bristol biologist Steve Simpson says. He and his colleagues raise some baby clownfish in tanks of regular seawater and others in water with higher levels of acidity that experts predict oceans will have in 2050. Then they played their subjects sound recordings of a coral reef where predators of clownfish typically lurk. The clownfish in today's seawater swam away from the loudspeaker, but those in tomorrow's environment didn't seem to notice the noise. That change suggests a potentially devastating effect of more acidic seawater on sea creatures, Simpson says. Sound not only helps fish stay safe, but it also is crucial for finding food and mates. Scientists aren't sure whether greater acidity disrupts a fish's nervous system, harms hearing in any other way, or changes the way that sound travels through the water. But however it works, they say it's one more indication of the profound changes a warmer atmosphere could bring to oceans and sea life. Our next item, job trends fuel obesity. A new report suggests that America's obesity epidemic may have less to do with what we eat than what we do all day. Only 1 in 5 workers puts in physically demanding hours today, as opposed to 1 in 2 in 1960, meaning we're burning an average of up to 140 fewer calories per day. The work environment has changed so much, we have to rethink how we're going to attack this problem. Timothy S. Church, an exercise researcher at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, tells the New York Times, Church and his colleagues used computer modeling and government labor data to calculate how much energy workers expended on the job from 1960 to 2008. Their findings suggest that the decline in careers that require standing and moving around largely accounts for the near tripling of obesity levels over that period. Changing your office routine to include regular jaunts to the printer or walks to visit colleagues, Church and other experts now say, could be just as crucial to your health as sitting or hitting the gym during the free time. And the next item, the moon's watery secret. Despite recent discoveries of ice in some of the moon's shadowy craters, scientists had their reasons for thinking its interior was bone dry. But a new analysis of lunar soil shows that the orb likely harbors underground water much as Earth does. That's forcing researchers to think hard about how the moon formed. Eric Hari, a geochemist at the Carnegie Institution of Washington, tells Space.com, astronomers generally agree that a Mars-sized body landed a glowing blow on Earth some 4.6 billion years ago, causing chunks of debris to break off and enter orbit before eventually fusing together to become our moon. They figured such an impact would have generated enough heat to boil away any water in those shards. But re-sifting through lunar dirt gathered on a 1972 Apollo mission, Hari and his colleagues found heavy concentrations of water in microscopic crystals formed by long-ago volcanic eruptions. Scientists aren't sure yet what the findings mean, except, Hari says, that there's something fundamental about the physics of the moon's early years that we still do not understand. And now our last item from Health and Science here. Why do smart kids grow up to be heavier drinkers? A pair of new studies suggests a correlation between intelligence and a thirst for alcohol. What's the connection? Don't worry, all that excessive drinking is just a sign of your intelligence, according to two long-term studies, one American, one British. There's a correlation between smarts and a thirst for alcohol. The more intelligent children in both studies grew up to drink alcohol more frequently and in greater quantities than less intelligent children, says Liz Day at Discover. Why might this be the case? It's all about evolution. Drinking alcohol was unintentional, accidental, and haphazard until about 10,000 years ago, says Satoshi Kanazawa at Psychology Today. Smart people are generally early adopters, and in the context of human history, the substance alcohol and the method of consumption are both evolutionary novel. Alcohol makes up for boring early years. I'm surprised at the findings, says Joanne Hinkle at the Frisky. So here's my pop psychology theory to explain it. All that studying in childhood repressed kids so much that they're still trying to compensate well into adulthood for all that fun they missed. Granted, that's just a theory. Drinking is the only way to deal with morons. Smart people booze so we can tolerate everyone else, says Greg at Food and Wine Blog. When sober, we tend to take people's responses at literal face value. But after a few drinks, we can relax a bit, stop being so anal with semantics, and let comments slide just a little bit. Now let's turn to some interesting items from the business section of the Week magazine. The issue of the week most recently was the auto bailout worth it? Success has many fathers, said Peter Greer in the Christian Science Monitor. In recent days, President Obama and Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney have both claimed credit for the now completed federal bailouts of General Motors and Chrysler. Obama has been touring auto plants in the Midwest, hailing the rescues. Today, this industry is growing stronger, he crowed. That's because you followed the plan I laid out in the column for the New York Times in 2008, Romney replied. It prescribed a managed bankruptcy that would wipe out shareholders, extract big concessions from bondholders and union members, and guarantee post-bankruptcy financing. Today, both automakers are profitable and have repaid much of their government financing. The president recognized I was right, Romney told CBS News, but he was hardly a lone voice in the wilderness. Managed bankruptcy was an option many experts talked a lot about at the time, and Romney's anti-Detroit tone was tougher than he would like for us to recall. Neither side has anything to brag about here, said David Skeel in the Wall Street Journal. The story goes that the bailouts averted disaster at remarkably little cost, but in fact, they made a mockery of the bankruptcy process. Each corporation pretended to sell its assets to a new entity that was set up for that purpose, and Fiat was awarded a large stake in the new Chrysler for an investment of $0. The presence of competing bidders could have lent the process some legitimacy, but they would have had to follow the outlines of the federal plan, including giving favorable treatment to unionized retirees. Speaking as a fan of the bailouts, even I find them troubling, said Daniel Howes in the Detroit News. The car companies survived, but not without a high cost in principle, contract law, and investor rights. Ask several million workers at the car companies and their suppliers if they care, said Rod Belloni on ClickOnDetroit.com, had the government not waded into the murky and fetid waters of the bankruptcies, no one else would have. The auto industry accounts for 5% of U.S. output, and the unemployment rate, which at its worst ticked up past 10%, could have doubled if Chrysler and GM had gone under. Let the president take his victory lap, especially since unemployment in the auto states of the Midwest is dropping fast, said Jonathan Cohn in the NewRepublic.com. Say what you will about the bankruptcy process. The Obama administration's intervention put people back to work, and that's what people want from their president. Our next item is from a section entitled Making Money, What the Experts Have to Say. And the first section here is called Why Corporate Bonds Are a Bad Bet. With U.S. interest rates at record lows, corporate America's best-known names are issuing trillions in new bonds, some with maturities as long as 100 years, said Bernard Condon in the Associated Press. But you're better off resisting because they're no bargain. Many of them offer interest so puny that investors are already losing money to inflation. Johnson & Johnson, for instance, just sold $4.4 billion in bonds, paying as little as 0.7%, a quarter point below the inflation rate. Rail company Norfolk Southern has even convinced investors to lend it $400 million for 100 years. Those bonds' 6% annual yield is well above today's inflation rate, but we've seen annual inflation of as high as 18% in the past 100 years, and of course the bigger question might be whether the railroad company will even be around in 2111. Our next item is called An Excuse to Snoop on the Neighbors. Nobody likes a busybody, but there are good reasons beyond sheer curiosity to take a peek when your neighbor holds an open house for prospective home buyers, says Amy Hoke in the Wall Street Journal. Even if you don't plan to sell your home soon, it's smart to know how your place stacks up against the competition. If you notice that five of your neighbors have recently fixed their roofs, for example, you might decide to make your own roof a top of home improvement priority. Conversely, if most of your neighbors are content with Formica, expensive granite countertops might not be a great investment. Open houses also offer an opportunity to see real estate agents in their natural element, giving you a chance to decide whether you can work with them. How long should you retain tax information? Confidential wisdom says to hold on to tax documents for 3 years after filing a return, said Liz Weston in the Los Angeles Times. But the conventional wisdom isn't always so wise. Many assisted living facilities, for example, want to see 5 years' worth of financial statements from prospective residents. Medicaid also looks back 5 years into would-be recipients' financial past to ensure that people aren't artificially impoverishing themselves by transferring money or assets before they apply for coverage. And the IRS can demand up to 6 years of records from taxpayers suspected of underreporting income. If you've already shredded your documents, most banks, brokers, and credit card companies will provide copies for a fee. And one final business item that you might find interesting: has Target lost its cool? Poor financials and bad press have experts wondering if the fashionable but affordable retailer has lost its cachet. Here are four theories behind Target's apparent decline. Before the recession, Target was the cheap, chic, cool kid of discount retail. But now retail analysts are wondering whether Target can bounce back with the economy. Shares of the Minneapolis-based company stock fell to their lowest point in a year earlier this month, down more than 25%. And the retailer saw just a 2% increase in same-store sales for the first quarter. What went wrong? Here are four theories. The first theory: the brand has become muddled. Target lost its cachet by emphasizing low prices on food and other basic goods during the recession, says Goldman Sachs retail analyst Adriana Shapira, as quoted in the Wall Street Journal. That might have been a smart move at the time, but it's driven away the higher-end shoppers who buy the cool stuff. It is as if Target has fallen off people's shopping list for discretionary products. Theory number two about Target: formerly uncool competitors caught up. Some of Target's struggles may also owe to the changing competitive landscape, says Ann Zimmerman in the Wall Street Journal. In its coolest days, the company was a cheaper chic innovator. Now competitors like Kohl's and JCPenney have taken a page from the Target playbook and added their own affordable designer goods, partnering with big names like Vera Wang and Ralph Lauren. The third theory here about Target is Target made poor political decisions. Blame Target's support for a conservative anti-gay group, says Jenna Sowers at Jezebel. Last year, Target gave $150,000 to a group that supported same-sex marriage opponents, causing Lady Gaga to block her new album from being sold at Target. For years, people who think themselves politically liberal regarded Target as a kinder, gentler, designery retail safe space, at least compared to Walmart's union-busting, Main Street-killing, profiteering corporate hydra. Now Target's reputation with liberals is fading, and the truth is rearing its not-so-cool head. And the final theory about Target, it's the economy, stupid. The problem here is that customers can't afford the pricey, trendy items that Target wants to be known for, says Kim Peterson at MSN Money. The economy is still flailing, and people just aren't spending a lot on discretionary items. But that's not the only reason the company's stock price is down. With many Americans still struggling to make ends meet, Target and Walmart are losing customers and even investors to even cheaper discount and dollar stores. And now let's turn to the arts section from The Week magazine, and now we'll take a look at a review of reviews of books. The book of the week within the last couple of weeks was entitled The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris by David McCullough. Oh, to be a young American in 19th century Paris, said Stacy Schiff in the New York Times, turning back the clock to a time long ago, before backpacks and Eurail passes, before Hemingway and Gertrude Stein. Historian David McCullough has created a portrait of the time that reads like a book of spells. In the 1830s, when his story begins, there were probably fewer than 1,000 Americans in Paris, and just about all of them shared a sense of pilgrimage and of enchantment. The wine cost almost nothing, and the Parisians were unfailingly polite. At the Louvre, U.S. citizenship opened the doors during the 5 days each week that the museum was officially closed. A good thing, too, since Yankee expats of that generation were earnest students. Most who'd been drawn to Paris were there to study art or medicine, not the nightlife. McCullough packs his early chapters with marvelous anecdotes and word pictures, said Max Bird in Salon.com. We're tossed on the Atlantic during these adventures' month-long voyage to Le Havre, and are stunned to see through their eyes just how old the farms and cathedrals of the old world truly are. The author's large but refreshingly original cast contains some familiar names, novelist James Fenimore Cooper and Henry James, painters John Singer Sargent and Mary Cassatt, inventor Samuel Morse, and physician Oliver Wendell Holmes. In many cases, we're told these travelers drew on their Parisian experiences to reshape America. Morse, who went to Paris, a painter, left with the idea that would allow him to invent the telegraph. After studying at the Sorbonne, alongside black medical students, Charles Sumner returned home to help spearhead the American abolitionist movement. It has to be said that The Greater Journey is less compelling than McCullough's other work, said Bruce Watson in the San Francisco Chronicle. His subjects are witnesses rather than makers of history, and the book has no plot beyond the vague notion that the 19th century Paris functioned as adolescent America's university. McCullough manages to produce intermittent surprises along the way, including a chilling account of what medicine looked like inside Paris's ballyhooed academies, and a description of the Prussians' 1870 siege of the city that reads like a good war novel. More important is that his love for the city comes through on every page, which has to please Paris's tourism bureau. It's likely his 558-page MASH note will entice a whole new generation of Francophiles. And the next book reviewed in the Week magazine, in this particular edition, is called Intern Nation: How to Earn Nothing and Learn Little in the Brave New Economy. Very few of us need to be told that there's something unjust about American employers' increasing reliance on unpaid and low-paid interns, said Katie Waldman in the Washington Post. The expected arguments are handled with wit and force in Ross Perlin's new study of the issue, he shows why most unpaid internships are actually illegal. He points out the moral bankruptcy of any employers who reap benefits from free labor, and he highlights how the system has become a barrier to certain white-collar opportunities for anyone who can't afford to forego decent wages. But Perlin's effort also proves that we've needed to have these issues put forward in a coherent way. The even-handedness of Intern Nation makes its diagnoses of injustice all the more chilling. Some big companies look bad even despite Perlin's good manners, said Roger Hodge in BookForum.com. With up to 8,000 interns working each year at its theme parks, Disney essentially operates one of the world's largest internship mills. Wages are minimal, rights negligible, and in exchange, these interns earn the privilege of flipping burgers or cleaning toilets. Perlin points out that 75% of college students now work in at least one internship before graduating. Of those interns who work for nothing, 75% are women. A reader would like to think that Washington might recognize that these labor force trends are creating a toxic race to the bottom. But you can't expect action from a city that depends on the arrival each year of about 20,000 interns to perform clerical duties, draft legislation, and sexually gratify their patrons. Perlin might be a bit too bothered by interns' forced subservience, said Molly Fisher in the New Republic. While his general call for reform is entirely appropriate, he neglects to consider, perhaps, the most valuable lessons that an internship can teach. Discovering that work can be bleak is a crucial step toward becoming a productive adult. Learning that no one is going to tell you how to make yourself useful might be more important still. And the author of the week in a recent edition of The Week magazine is Gene Hackman. Writing probably isn't the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of Gene Hackman, said Belinda Luscombe in Time. Yet the actor, who is now 81 years old, hasn't made a movie since 2004, and in that time he's written or co-written three novels. His latest, Payback at Morning Peak, is a western that begins violently. His main character, Jubal Young, finds his mother dead, shoots his father, and tries in vain to save his sister's life, all in the first chapter. I wanted to dig myself into a hole so that I would have 300 pages to get myself out, Hackman says. I kind of maybe overdid it a bit. The violence in the book may mirror the violence of Hackman's early film characters, but the actor warns not to read too much into that. Hollywood loves to typecast, and I guess they saw me as a violent guy. I don't see myself as a violent guy. A few elements of Hackman's true self do show up in his protagonist, said Michael Haney in GQ. I had a troubled youth, he says, referring to the father who walked out on him, and his own decision to leave home at 16. Hackman became a very young Marine, and echoes of that challenge are in the novel, too. A lot of what I experienced as a young man, I kind of exaggerated into what this young Jubal may have found himself doing. Any wisdom that the book imparts, he says, owes to his mother, not to him. They tell you not to write about your mom in books, but I don't know how you keep from doing that. And finally, in the book section here, there's a brief comment about four relatively new books all about the Wild West. And the first one is called David Crockett, The Lion of the West by Michael Wallace. Despite the song's assertion, Davy Crockett most likely didn't kill him a bar when he was only three, said Alan Barra in the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. Michael Wallace's splendid biography gets to the bottom of this and other Crockett myths. We learn that the tracker and marksman had never heard of the Alamo before landing in the middle of Texas's fight for liberty. We also learn that his bravery during that battle earned him his distinction as a true American folk hero. The next Western is called The Last Gunfight by Jeff Gruen. It's actually Jeff Gwynn. I'm sorry, G-U-I-N-N. Last Gunfight by Jeff Gwynn. Jeff Gwynn's riveting account of the gunfight at the OK Corral creates a canvas of the Old West that Frederick Remington would envy, said Punch Shaw in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. According to Gwynn, the legendary gun battle outside Tombstone, Arizona, didn't even happen in a corral, but in a vacant lot. No matter, Gwynn's evocative portraits of the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday and his retelling of the shocking events that took place before and after the battle keep the pages turning. The next Western here is called Doc, a Novel by Mary Doria Russell. Mary Doria Russell's fantastic new novel recasts the Doc Holliday of legend as a rough mixture of fury, gentility, and bourbon, said Ron Charles in the Washington Post. Diagnosed with tuberculosis in his 20s, John Henry Holliday, Doc Holliday, spent his short adulthood mixing a commitment to dentistry with a talent for card playing. Throughout the book, Russell dismantles rickety legends while reconstructing her own larger-than-life characters on a firmer foundation of psychological insight. And the final item that we'll mention here from this book section is a Western called The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt. If Cormac McCarthy had a sense of humor, he might have concocted a story like Patrick DeWitt's bloody, darkly funny Western, said Carolyn Kellogg in the Los Angeles Times. DeWitt's tale centers on the misadventures of Oregon gunslingers, Eli and Charlie Sisters, who are hired to kill a California prospector. Narrated by Eli, the story is carried along by the brothers' quirky encounters with dead Indians, a possible witch, and a dentist who introduces Eli to the art of brushing one's teeth. And now let's flip back to the magazine, to the last word section in the week, which is always an interesting item, I believe. And I've selected one, actually, that appeared just a few months ago that I thought was one of the best and the most interesting last word columns that I had read. It is called Made Up Minds. Since political beliefs are rooted in emotion, says Chris Mooney, the facts are often irrelevant. A man with a conviction is a hard man to change. Tell him you disagree, and he turns away. Show him facts or figures, and he questions your sources. Appeal to logic, and he fails to see your point. So wrote the celebrated Stanford University psychologist Leon Festinger in a passage that might have been referring to arguments over the president's birthplace or the causes of climate change and autism. But it was too early for all that. This was in the 1950s when this was written, and Festinger was actually describing what would become a famous case study in psychology, a group of Chicago UFO devotees who thought they were communicating with extraterrestrial beings. On December 21st, 1954, the day the cult leaders had said the world would end in cataclysm, Festinger and his team were with the Seekers, whom they had decided to study. This was the moment he was waiting for. How would people so emotionally invested in a belief system react now that it had been soundly refuted? When the prophecy failed, the group struggled for an explanation. But then rationalization set in. A new message arrived from the aliens, announcing that the Seekers had been spared at the last minute. Festinger summarized the extraterrestrials' new pronouncement. The little group, sitting all night long, had spread so much light that God had saved the world from destruction. From that day forward, the Seekers, previously shy of the press and indifferent toward evangelizing, began to proselytize. Their sense of urgency was enormous, wrote Festinger. The devastation of all they had believed had made them even more certain of their beliefs. In the annals of denial, it doesn't get more extreme than that. The cultists lost their jobs, the press mocked them, and there were efforts to keep them away from impressionable young minds. But though the seekers might lie at the far end of the spectrum of human self-delusion, there's plenty to go around. And since Festinger's day, an array of new discoveries in psychology and neuroscience has further demonstrated how our pre-existing beliefs, far more than any new facts, can skew our thoughts and color what we consider our most dispassionate and logical conclusions. This tendency toward motivated reasoning helps explain why we find groups still polarized over matters where the evidence is so unequivocal. It seems that expecting people to be convinced by the facts flies in the face of, well, you know, the facts. The theory of motivated reasoning builds on a key insight of modern neuroscience. Reasoning is actually suffused with emotion, what researchers often call affect. Not only are the two inseparable, but our positive or negative feelings about people, things, and ideas arise much more rapidly than our conscious thoughts in a matter of milliseconds, fast enough to detect with an EEG device, but long before we're aware of them ourselves. That shouldn't be surprising. Evolution required us to react very quickly to stimuli in our environment. It's a basic human survival skill, explains political scientist Arthur Lupia of the University of Michigan. We push threatening information away, we pull friendly information close. We apply fight or flight reflexes not only to predators, but to data itself. In other words, by the time we're consciously reasoning, we may instead be rationalizing our prior emotional commitments, or to use an analogy offered by the University of Virginia psychologist Jonathan Haidt, we may think we're being scientists, but we're actually being lawyers. Our reasoning is a means to a predetermined end, winning our case, and is shot through with biases. These include confirmation bias, in which we give greater heed to evidence and arguments that bolster our beliefs, and disconfirmation bias, in which we expend disproportionate energy trying to refute views and arguments that we find uncongenial. Plainly put, if I don't want to believe that my spouse is being unfaithful or that my child is a bully, I can go to great lengths to explain away behavior that seems obvious to everyone else. Modern science originated from an attempt to weed out such subjective lapses. What Francis Bacon, that great 17th century theorist of the scientific method, dubbed the idols of the mind. Our individual responses to the conclusions that science reaches, however, are quite another matter. Because researchers employ so much nuance and disclose so much uncertainty, scientific evidence is highly susceptible to selective reading. Giving ideologues or partisans scientific data that's relevant to their beliefs is like unleashing them in the motivated reasoning equivalent of a candy store. And it's not just that people twist or selectively read scientific evidence to support their pre-existing views. According to research by Yale Law School professor Dan Kahan and his colleagues, people's deep-seated views about morality and about the way society should be ordered strongly predict whom they consider to be a legitimate scientific expert in the first place, and thus where they consider scientific consensus to lie on contested issues. Kahan classified individuals based on their cultural values as either individualists or communitarians, and as either hierarchical or egalitarian in outlook. A hierarchical individualist finds it difficult to believe that the things he prizes, commerce, industry, a man's freedom to possess a gun to defend his family, that sort of thing, could lead to outcomes deleterious to society. Egalitarian communitarians tend to think that the free market causes harm, that patriarchal families mess up kids, and that people can't handle guns. And the group split dramatically on global warming. But the study subjects weren't anti-science, not in their own minds anyway. It's just that science was whatever they wanted to believe. And that undercuts the standard notion that the way to persuade most people is via evidence and argument. In fact, head-on attempts to persuade can sometimes trigger a backfire effect. Where people not only fail to change their minds when confronted with the facts, they may hold their wrong views more tenaciously than ever. Northwestern University sociologist Monica Prasad and her colleagues wanted to test whether they could dislodge the belief that Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda were secretly collaborating among those most likely to believe it, Republican partisans from highly GOP-friendly counties. So the researchers set up a study in which they discussed the topics with the subjects. Then they cited the findings of the 9/11 Commission, as well as a statement by George W. Bush himself denying that his administration had ever said the 9/11 attacks were orchestrated between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. As it turned out, not even Bush's own words could change the minds of these Bush voters, just one of the 49 partisans who originally believed the Iraq Al-Qaeda claim changed his or her mind, one out of 49. A far more common reaction was resisting the facts, either by coming up with counter-arguments or by simply being unmovable. But how irrational is this in the end? On one hand, it doesn't make sense to discard an entire belief system built up over a lifetime because of some new snippet of information. It is quite possible to say, I reached this pro-capital punishment decision based on real information that I arrived at over my life, explained Stanford social psychologist John Krosnick. Indeed, there's another sense in which science denial could be considered keenly rational. In certain conservative communities, explains Yale's Kahan, people who say, I think there's something to this whole climate change thing, that's going to mark them out as a certain kind of person, and their life is going to go less well. If you want to show how and why fact is ditched in favor of motivated reasoning, you could find no better test case than climate change. After all, it's an issue where you have highly technical information on one hand and very strong beliefs on the other. And sure enough, one key predictor of whether you accept the science of global warming is whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. The two groups have grown more divided in their views, even as the science becomes more unequivocal. And it turns out that education has little to do with it as well. On the contrary, in a 2008 Pew survey, only 19% of college-educated Republicans agreed that the planet is warming due to human actions, versus 31% of non-college-educated Republicans. Among Democrats and independents, higher education correlated with greater acceptance of science. Other studies have shown a similar effect. Republicans who say they understand the global warming issue best are least concerned about it. And among Republicans and those with higher levels of distrust of science in general, learning more about the issue doesn't increase one's concern about it. What's going on here? Well, according to political scientist Charles Tabor and Milton Lodge of Stony Brook, one insidious aspect of motivated reasoning is that political sophisticates are prone to be more biased than those who know less about the issues. People who have a dislike of some policy, for example, abortion, if they're unsophisticated, they can just reject it out of hand, says Lodge. But if they're sophisticated, they can go one step further and start coming up with counter-arguments. These individuals are just as emotionally driven and biased as the rest of us, but they're able to generate more and better reasons to explain why they're right, and so their minds become harder to change. Is there a case study of science denial that largely occupies the political left? Yes. The disproved claim that childhood vaccines are causing an epidemic of autism. Its most famous proponents are an environmentalist, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Hollywood celebrities, Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey. The Huffington Post gives a large megaphone to denialists, and Seth Mnuchin, author of the new book, The Panic Virus, notes that if you want to find vaccine deniers, hang out at Whole Foods. Vaccine denial has all the hallmarks of a belief system that's not amenable to refutation. Over the past decade, the assertion that childhood vaccines are driving autism rates has been undermined by multiple epidemiological studies, as well as the simple fact that autism rates continue to rise even though the alleged offending agent in vaccines, which is a mercury-based preservative called thimerosal, has long since been removed. Yet the true believers persist, critiquing each new study that challenges their views and rallying to the defense of disgraced researcher Andrew Wakefield, even after his 1998 Lancet paper, which originated the current vaccine scare, was retracted and he subsequently lost his license to practice medicine in the UK. But then why should we be surprised? Vaccine deniers created their own partisan media, such as the website Age of Autism, that instantly blast our critiques and counterarguments whenever any new development casts further doubt on anti-vaccine views. The upshot, left or right, conservative or liberal, we all wear blinders in some situations. Then the question becomes, what can be done to counteract human nature itself, given the power of our prior beliefs? One idea is becoming clear. If you want someone to accept new evidence, make sure to present it in a context that doesn't trigger a defensive, emotional reaction. This theory is gaining traction in part because of Kahan's work at Yale. In one study, he and his colleagues packaged the science of climate change into made-up newspaper articles bearing two very different headlines: Scientific Panel Recommends Anti-Pollution Solution to Global Warming, and Scientific Panel Recommends Nuclear Solution to Global Warming. And then tested how citizens with different values responded. Sure enough, the latter framing made hierarchical individualists much more open to accepting the fact that humans are causing global warming. Kahan infers that the effect occurred because the science had been written into a narrative that appealed to those with a pro-industry worldview. Followed to its logical conclusion here, this means that conservatives are more likely to embrace climate science if it comes from a religious or business leader who can set the issue in a context of values that differ from those of environmentalists. This effectively signals a détente in what Kahan calls a culture war effect. In other words, paradoxically, don't lead with the facts in order to convince. Lead with the values so as to give the facts a fighting chance. And that was written from a longer article by Chris Mooney that originally appeared in Mother Jones and is available at motherjones.com. And you're listening to a reading of some of the best of the Week magazine from the last couple of months here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thanks so much for joining me today. And now let's turn to the consumer section in the Week magazine and look at a few of the tips of the week. The first one is how to reduce cell phone radiation, something we've all been hearing quite a bit about in recent weeks. Give your phone some space. It shouldn't have been a big shock when the World Health Organization categorized cell phones as a possible carcinogenic hazard. User manuals typically advise against direct contact. Holding a cell phone 2 inches from your ear reduces the radiation by a factor of 4. Get wired. Using a wired earpiece can cut radiation even more. If you're worried about low-level radiation emitted by the wire itself, minimize it by spending a few bucks on a ferrite choke. Avoid Bluetooth wireless earpieces, which emit radiation right at the ear. And pick your spots. Few people can forswear cell chats altogether. But do note that a phone emits more radiation when it is in motion or receiving a weak signal. Safest, in fact, are calls that you receive outside near a cell tower while standing perfectly still. Might be a little hard for some people to find, but nonetheless, that's what they say. Here's another tip of the week. How to stick to an exercise routine. Focus on the finish. Immediate desires typically govern our actions, so know that skipping your daily exercise will always be a temptation. When your resolve wavers, leapfrog your inertia with this pep talk. 25 minutes from now, I'm going to feel amazing. Also, share fitness goals with friends. It's harder to wimp out when someone else can hold you to your word. Diversify. If weight loss is your goal, expect to plateau weeks or months into your routine. When that happens, try switching things up. If you turn from swimming to running, for instance, the weight will come off as your body rises to the challenge. And improvise. If childcare duties prevent a trip to the gym, join the kids in a game of soccer or tag. On rainy days, stage a dance party. Remember, there's no such thing as too busy to work out. Here's another tip of the week from a Week magazine, How to Survive Allergy Season, something everyone needs, I think. Plan ahead. Allergies kick in when your immune system mistakes pollen for a harmful substance, releasing histamines that irritate your eyes and nose. That's why antihistamines, which block histamine's effects, work best when taken before symptoms occur. If you prefer taking natural supplements such as stinging nettle, try to start several weeks prior to allergy season. Keep pollens outside. Your home's doors and windows should remain shut during pollen season because allergens can be tracked in on hair and clothing. A shower and a change of clothes will cut down on the irritants you spread after re-entering. Cool your eyes. Besides decongestants, cold compresses and caffeine can offer some relief from allergy symptoms. A compress or an eye cream that includes caffeine will help you look and feel better. And our final consumer tip, how to cut travel costs. Buy on Tuesday. Most airlines begin their sales Monday evening, and rivals usually match the lowered fares by the next day. It pays to look for sales 3 to 4 months before you travel. That's when airlines begin to look closely at which route may need a sale to fill the seats. Ask for a refund. Many airlines offer a partial refund if a fare drops after you purchased a ticket. YAPTA, that's YAPTA.com, helps get you that refund by sending you an email or tweet when the price drops. AutoSlash.com offers a similar service for car rentals. Save when you park. BestParking.com steers drivers toward the cheapest parking at off-airport lots near 79 domestic airports. Rates are updated frequently, and the site offers a free app for smartphone users. And don't pay to check a bag. Using American Express's Delta SkyMiles branded credit card allows you to check a bag at no cost. All good tips there. And a couple of final notes here from the business section. The Department of Transportation has fined Continental Airlines $120,000 for excluding fuel charges from its fare listings. U.S. Airways paid $45,000 for failing to inform customers of all taxes and fees that apply to airfares to Rome. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. This was kind of a week extra with some of the best articles from the last couple of months of the Week magazine, and I hope you enjoyed hearing some of them. We read from a few sections that we don't normally read from. Be sure to listen next time. I really hope you've enjoyed this episode. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.